Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, Jean-Marc Grodi, and once again, we have this awesome privilege to sit back and have a cup of coffee and hear a story, a conversion story, a story of how our Lord has brought another of his children home to his church, to his sacraments. We're joined tonight by Lauren DeWitt, a former Southern Baptist, a preacher's kid like myself. And we'll talk a little bit about her website, thecontemplativehomemaker.com, a little later on. But Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. I'm excited to hear your story. Again, we've got that pastor's kid connection.
Absolutely.
There, and we were talking a bit beforehand. Again, we'll talk about your website later, but the domestic church, you know, seeking holiness in the family and ordinary life, that's something I'm really passionate about.
So absolutely.
I want to hear about that work later on. But we'll start by going way back. Where does your spiritual journey begin?
Well, probably like yourself, it began from birth because my father was a Baptist minister. So I grew up, I was baptized when I was 6 years old by my father, and it was such a natural thing for me. Our church life was really close-knit. I was born in Baton Rouge, but this period of my life, I was in Houma, Louisiana, which is very deep South Louisiana. And our entire lives revolved around our little church that was on the bayou there. All of my best friends were at my church. I didn't know anybody that wasn't Christian. We were there every Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday evenings. All the ladies that went to the church were my aunts and uncles, you know, just friends of the family. And it was a really sweet time in my life. And it was just, I remember when I was six, I was like, of course, I need to invite Jesus into my life. And I went down the aisle for that altar call and was baptized on Easter Sunday that year. And never really questioned it at all. And we moved around quite a bit since my dad was a Baptist minister. So my earliest memories are from in Houma. And we moved to Murray, Kentucky for a couple of years for another church. And then when I was in sixth grade, we moved down to Mobile, Alabama. And that's where my family lived until I ended up moving to Baton Rouge, where I live now, after law school. But I think my Southern Baptist upbringing might be a little different from your typical Southern Baptist because most of my time was spent in very heavily Catholic areas. So unlike a lot of Southern Baptists, I know there's a tendency sometimes to see Catholicism as some kind of other form. To me, it was just another branch of Christianity. We were all just kind of different flavors coming off the same tree. We knew so many Catholics. And my dad, to his credit, did a lot of work with ecumenism in the time that he was in those areas. He would always say, you know, if you love your Bible, and we as Baptists, we love our Bibles, you need to thank a Catholic because we got it from the Catholic Church. And he always...
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was really unusual. Yeah. I didn't realize that it was unusual at the time. I guess just because, again, growing up in South Louisiana and in the Mobile area is very, very Catholic. So I knew a lot of Catholics. When I was six or seven, if you asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said I wanted to be a Baptist nun. I wanted to be the first Baptist nun. I guess we'd seen a nun at the grocery store or something, and I thought it was amazing that she had a wedding ring on and that she was married to Jesus. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I was like, I'm going to do that. Wow. So I loved it. I always loved that more high church liturgy. When we moved to Mobile, my parents enrolled me in Episcopal school there. And that was kind of my first exposure to a more formal liturgical rite. And I thought it was just stunningly beautiful. And that really meant a lot to me growing up. And so maybe my experience was a little bit different from the typical Southern Baptist, the stereotypical thing. But I had a very... generous view, I suppose, towards Catholicism because of that.
Yeah, that's, you know, it is very interesting. And I wonder if it's a bit of a sign of the times that we do, I feel like, have more people nowadays for whom even the title Protestant doesn't quite fit. And they may not even claim it for themselves because they're not protesting.
Right.
You know, they're very much past that. And so there's an openness at times to Catholicism because there's not the baggage that there might have been there in the past.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I would agree with that.
We're speaking tonight to Lauren DeWitt, former Southern Baptist. Her website is thecontemplativehomemaker.com, which we'll talk about more later. So yeah, a very interesting upbringing there. What happened next?
Yeah, so like I said, the first years of my life, up until really when we moved to Mobile, when I was in sixth grade, my faith was just sort of a given. It was a very sweet part of my life. I never questioned it. I never thought about it.
That's beautiful.
When we moved to Mobile, though, and I don't know if this was because it was middle school, and so it was a different time, or if that was the first time that our social lives started being more than just people inside our church. And so I started being exposed to some different things that I started sort of separating my faith life and my spiritual life into these two separate things. And I think, you know, when I look back on this time, still everyone I knew was culturally Christian. But I think what may have been really damaging to me at the time was that a lot of us were culturally Christian, but what we were doing at church on Sundays wasn't necessarily informing what we were doing throughout the week. And so we would go to these youth group experiences, you know, and they're geared to give you an emotional response. And, you know, they get all the kids like hyped up, and then they have the altar call and the music and the dark lights and all that stuff. And I spent, you know, every summer I was at Cross Point or Ridgecrest and those kind of places. And I was going on all these mission trips and things. And so I started to kind of get a bad taste in my mouth about it, even at an early age, because I felt like it was geared to force an emotional response. Mm-hmm. And then we would come back into our regular lives, and the same kids that I was going to church with and school with were out partying on the weekends and that sort of thing. And so there just started to be this disconnect for me that I started to notice. And I began to feel, in some ways, and this may a lot have been just in my head, just as a teenage girl growing up, but just very separated from everyone else, because as the preacher's daughter, and I don't know if you experienced this as having a dad who was a minister, you're kind of in a fishbowl. And so I was expected, or I felt that I was expected to uphold a certain image. And so it made me feel very different from my peers who were sort of living one way at church and living another way on the weekends. And I wouldn't get invited to parties and things on the weekends and that kind of stuff. And I always felt like, well, it's because I'm a preacher's kid. And they just, you know, they don't think I'm cool enough, that kind of thing. And so this ended up being a very, a big thing in my mind, that I was feeling very separated and I was feeling very defined by my dad's job. Mm. And like everything I did had to uphold this image.
So for a Baptist, for a Southern Baptist, one of the things that I think we don't often recognize among Christians of different denominations, different doctrines, is there's a trickle down of that doctrine to what the actual practice of the faith was, mm-hmm. like the spirituality. You know, what did it mean for a Baptist? And again, you had this beautiful upbringing, mm-hmm. A beautiful relationship with the Lord at an early age, mm-hmm. and desire to be baptized. But for a Southern Baptist, what does it look like to keep growing in the faith?
Right. And so...
What was the idea there? What were you doing? You know, was it just more of the same?
It was more of the same. I mean, the emphasis in the Southern Baptist Church, and again, there's wide variation, sure. amongst the Baptist churches, but the way I grew up, it was personal Bible reading, okay. Memorize scripture, pray. But then there was never any sort of, I was never taught how to pray. It was just like, you're supposed to do it, but maybe they'd give you like a Bethmore Bible study or something like that. But then once you finish the Bible study, you're like, okay, I guess I just need to buy another packaged product.
Gotcha.
And it started feeling like sort of the same thing over and over. Another big thing that was causing this sort of dualism, I guess, for me was in my Southern Baptist upbringing, drinking was a huge no-no. Mm. But since we were living in a heavily Catholically cultured area, a lot of the Southern Baptists I knew did drink socially. But it caused this...
We were bad influence.
But it caused this like really strange thing, right? Because my dad and our family, being the minister's family, we couldn't drink because Baptists don't do that. But I knew all of the other church members were enjoying a glass of wine and things like that. And then, like I said, a lot of the, you know, when we were teenagers, my friends and youth group were going out and drinking and doing a lot of the things that teenagers unfortunately get into.
Yeah.
I just started feeling this fragmentation to where I'm like, well, we're supposed to be doing this one thing, but we're all doing different things. And it's kept under the big joke is, you know, Baptists still drink, but they don't do it in public.
Yeah.
And so it started to just, something about it just started to feel really off to me. And that's just one example, but sure. there are lots of little ways that I just started feeling like things that we're doing at church aren't lining up with the way I'm seeing it lived.
Sure.
Even amongst Christian families.
Yeah. Well, that's why I ask about the spirituality, because it is one of the keys here is that we need a faith that gives us the right picture of the universe, mm-hmm. of reality, but then also that walks us through translating that into taking over more of our, you know, informing more and more of our life.
Right.
And oftentimes in various Christian circles, or even amongst Catholics, when they're not catechized well,
right,
it goes so far, but no further, because what do I do with this in my social life,
right,
or my work or my school, or how does this inform everything else? And it kind of stops there, right?
Right. And it's kind of ironic because, you know, the big catchphrase as a Southern Baptist is like, do you have Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior? Right. And I knew that intellectually, and yes, that was the truth, but there was never any like actual personal relationship with it.
Yeah.
You know, and now having the benefit of being Catholic, I see all these Lectio Divina, Liturgy of the Hours, various devotions. We didn't have any of that in the Southern Baptist tradition. And so to me, it was like if you didn't have your canned Bible study that you picked up at Lifeway Christian Bookstore, I didn't really know what to do with it. And then it was also very surface level. I felt like a lot of the stuff we were getting in youth group was always about, you know, don't drink, save yourself for marriage. And that was what they would talk about every single week. And then you'd leave youth group and everybody was doing it, you know? And so it was like, well, is this it? Is this what there is? There just seems to be this disconnect between it. And nobody's really doing what we're purporting to believe. Right. So does it matter?
Right. So you're seeing this disconnect, this fragmentation, and almost perhaps seeing it in a more concrete way because of being a pastor's kid, you're seeing a bit more of the disconnect. So does that push you towards a tipping point, or what happened?
Yeah, so by the time I was ready to go off to college, I was really, really ready to define myself apart from my family and to figure out who Lauren Ellis, you know, at the time was. My parents really wanted me to go to a Baptist college it was in Alabama, in Birmingham. And I had every good reason to go there. I got a full scholarship and everything. And I said, no, I'm not going. I'm not going to go be Terry Ellis's daughter again somewhere else. I want to know who Lauren Ellis is, not Terry Ellis's daughter. And so I picked a college that was 10 hours away from home, where I think I knew maybe one other person from my hometown that was there, where nobody knew me, where I could go and sort of figure things out. And I was very attracted by secular culture. I don't know if that's because my parents lived such a more modest lifestyle, and there wasn't any drinking in our house. And we, you know, we didn't do all the big fancy trips and the shopping and things like that. And I grew up in a very wealthy area in Alabama. And so there, I just felt very different and other. And so I wanted to go and experience all this that I felt like my parents were keeping from me in some way.
Okay. So you go to that college.
Yeah. I go to college. Yeah. And it's shocking to me when I look back on it now. You would think growing up with as much built-in institutional Christian activities as I did. I mean, I was in church Sunday mornings, evenings, Monday nights for choir practice, Wednesday evenings for youth group. My summers, I don't think I had a single week in the summer that was not at an overnight camp or a mission trip or VBS or that sort of thing. And so you would think that maybe for a little while when I went to college, I would have kept up some of that. I stopped going to church the first weekend I went to college.
Wow.
Yeah, the very first weekend that I was there, I went out. And, you know, the other thing I always heard growing up, I would hear other adults tell my parents, you know, if you're too strict on her and if you don't let her experience things, she's going to go wild when he goes to college. And so to me, I saw that sort of as like, yep, I'm going to do it. I'm going to follow. And it seems so silly now, right? Mm. It's so ridiculous. But I just felt like my parents were somehow holding out on me. Mm. And hearing other adults say that and knowing they were telling my parents that, and then seeing this disconnect between other, you know, people that were faithful members in our church, that were deacons in the church and things like that, and knowing y'all aren't doing the stuff we talk about on Sunday. It made me very quickly just throw it all out.
Hmm. That's interesting. We'll have to return to that self-fulfilling prophecy of, she's going to...
I was like, I guess this is what we do, huh?
Because there might be something to that, but it is this question of, you know, how do you live out, you know, your faith in your family and what boundaries do you put up? But we'll have to return to that.
Yeah, for sure.
One parent to another.
Yeah.
So yeah, you threw it off real quick.
Yeah, so I get to college, I'm drinking like the first weekend we're out there, like literally never maybe tasted alcohol once in high school. I was a really good kid growing up. Like I followed the rules and held up the image that I felt like I was supposed to have as the Baptist preacher's kid. So, you know, start drinking. I end up getting into recreational drug use. I start having unchaste relationships. I really bought into the women need to be like men kind of thing to be able to go out there and experience and do whatever they want without consequences. And if you get judged for it, that's because that other person is sexist, not because what you're doing is objectively wrong. And I remember my first, I guess it was by the end of my first year of college, I thought going to college and finding myself apart from my parents' values was going to, you know, be fulfilling in some way. Like, I'm going to finally know who I really am. That angst, that fragmenting that I had begun experiencing in high school, it just got worse. And I remember calling my dad, because, you know, Southern Baptists, we believe in once saved, always saved. And I remember calling my dad one summer, and I guess it was the first summer after my freshman year, and I was like, are you sure? Is that true? Am I saved? How do I know? Because I knew I wasn't doing the right things. And I knew I was doing everything that I had been told growing up not to do. And my dad said, no, you're fine. You need to put that fear away. And so I said, okay, I'll put it away and I'll keep going. And I'm entitled in some way to find my happiness here. And if I'm once saved, always saved, then that means God's just going to make it work out for me.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, it didn't go well.
So, you know, what an interesting conversation there. And what we'll find, and again, I'm sure we'll talk about sort of in the postmortem, you know, when we look back toward the end here, is just so many of the, what we would call heresy, you know, incorrect beliefs, there's a kernel of truth, right? Like what Christians are grasping at in the once saved, always saved is this confidence and power of God, right?
Yeah.
Like there's something good and true there.
Absolutely.
But it's not the whole picture.
Right.
And so it falls flat outside of the context of the whole,
right,
which we believe we have. But there is something, I mean, you imagine a father to his daughter, you know, like.
It brings the parenting element in there too. Yeah. I mean, as a dad, as a mom, if my kid's coming to me with this like crisis of faith, I don't want her to think that Jesus hates her, know, and that she's going to hell for sure. And so I know, I mean, I don't blame my parents for anything. They did the best they could and they were very faithful, wonderful people. I'm only sorry I put them through so much, he was doing his best to try to say something that would keep me in the light. And I took it and ran 180 degrees different direction with it.
Okay. Yeah. So there was further to the bottom of that?
You know, I kept drinking, I was sleeping around quite a bit, occasional drug use. I got extremely depressed to the point where I was self-harm, very seriously contemplating suicide. And this was around my junior year, maybe, of college. And so when I got to that point in high school, I'd struggled with that in high school as well, this depression. The solution in high school was, we'll go off to college. You need a change of scene. You need to be able to find yourself. So I was a junior going into my senior year. Well, I just need to graduate and get out of this town and go somewhere else, and then things will be fine. And I was graduating, and this is another interesting thing. You know, growing up, I didn't have any idea of vocation. That's not something we ever talked about. And so growing up, the big thing was you need to get a career. You need to be able to take care of yourself. If you're going to college, you can't major in, I was really interested in like French and art history and things like that. You can't major in that because you can't get a career in that. So it's like, okay, well, I'll be an accountant. I will do accounting. I didn't like accounting. I was good at school. So I was good at doing whatever I needed to do to get the degree. And so graduation's looming. I'm extremely unhappy. I'm very suicidal. Like, I'm not ready to graduate. I don't want to be an accountant. I have no idea. Like, the whole goal of my life growing up till now was to get into a good college, to get a good scholarship, and to get a degree that I could have a career in. And now I'm only 21, graduating, and I'm supposed to do the rest of my life. Like, what even comes after this? So I figured I'd go to law school. Like, literally, it was a very legally blonde kind of thing. I'm really embarrassed to admit, where I just woke up, I was like, yeah, 3 more years of school. That'll give me time to figure it out. And by that point, I'll feel better about things. I'll have it all put together. And so, you know, very predictably, I go to law school. And again, I'm a great student. And I try not to say that with any pride or anything. I had a wonderful resume. If you looked at my resume, I was doing all the right extracurriculars. I was in all the right clubs. I had leadership positions. I had a fantastic GPA. And I got to law school, and I was doing the same thing. And I was getting offers for clerking at some of the best firms in the Southeast. And so I was really proud. But on the inside and in my personal life, I was an absolute wreck. And instead of learning from the mistakes that I made in college, I went to law school and started doing the exact same things I was doing there and ending up surprised, like, why am I still not happy? Why is all this not fixing things? And so it was at that point, towards the end of my second year, so law school's 3 years long, it was towards the middle of my second year that I started realizing, I think the drinking is a problem. This is not helping things. It's causing me a lot of anxiety. I was on antidepressants at the time. I was like, my antidepressants can't even work because I'm drinking so much. So I decided to stop drinking. I started making a few changes in my life, and they were really positive. I actually started checking out an Episcopal church that was nearby, but I wasn't changing some of my other lifestyles. And that's when I found out I was pregnant. And it was a guy that I didn't know very well. He was in my law school class with me. I had actually told him a few days before I found out I was pregnant, like, I don't think this is not going to work out. We hadn't even really been together very long at all. But, you know, it was nice knowing you, see you in class, that sort of thing. And then I find out later that I'm pregnant. And I remember very clearly getting that pregnancy test. And I was in my bathroom in my apartment. I hadn't prayed in years. Yeah. I had not prayed at all. I'd gone back to church a couple times here and there. I had this sense that, like, okay, there's some basic things I need to do to stop causing more chaos in my life and getting better people around me that are more stable. But I really hadn't prayed. And I saw those two pink lines and I said, God, I need help. I need help. So I called my dad, and I was so afraid he was going to be mad at me. He came up and bought me a steak, drove up to Birmingham, bought me a steak. He was so proud of me for wanting to keep the baby. Oh. And I came home that weekend. It was Memorial Day weekend, 2012. My mom put a sign on the door that said, "Welcome home, Lauren and baby." Yeah. And I had been so afraid that my parents would be so ashamed of me, because I was ashamed of myself. I was so embarrassed. I'd hurt so many people. I was so selfish. And they had that sign there for me. And so I went back to school. Summer clerkships were starting up at that time. And I needed to tell the guy, right? So I tell him, and I had plans. I was like, you know, we can make this work. This is definitely not an ideal situation. And I should say, I had been pro-choice before this. I had always thought, I knew that there were risks to living the way that I was living. And I had always just assumed if I found myself pregnant, I would go get an abortion. But for whatever reason, when I saw that pregnancy test, I was like, this is a baby. This is my baby. Wow. And that's why I named her Emily Grace, because she was Grace. Yeah. She was a pure gift to me at that time. But I had intentions to work it out. You know, there's people that make the two-parent home thing work, and we can do this. We're both going to get good jobs. We're both in the top of our law school class. It's going to be fine. He was not fine with it. And so I was put under a lot of pressure to have an abortion from his family. And I just found I couldn't keep going to school with somebody that I felt so much pressure from. And I was getting, you know, emails from his family about how I was making the wrong choice. I was going to ruin both of our lives. And think about all the things that I have worked for. You know, you're about to get this big career going, and, you know, you're going to miss out on vacations with friends and things like that. And what really ticked me off, this is kind of ironic, they accused me of allowing my parents' beliefs to dictate what I was doing. And it ticked me off so much because I was like, I've spent the last 6 years trying to find out who I am apart from my parents' beliefs. And this this was my choice.
Yeah.
I've decided everything against what my parents said going on through the last 6 years, but this was not because of my parents. This was pure grace. This was just a gift. So I moved back home with my parents during this time. I was so surprised at how welcoming church members were. You know, during this time, I had always thought I'd gotten so, you know, big city and secular worldview. I'd started thinking of people who had faith as being very provincial. But it was the people at my parents' little Baptist church that helped me get into law school again in Baton Rouge. They helped find me a new clerkship job. They threw me a baby shower. Yeah. I didn't get maternity leave in law school. I had my daughter on Friday before Martin Luther King weekend. I was back in class on Tuesday. Wow. But I had little old ladies lined up at church that wanted to keep her for me. And so it was such a real gift. And that was such a stark contrast to me because I'd been in such a pro-choice world that in thinking that people that were pro-life were so dumb and so off base, and to just see them with just pure love, and they were so excited and so helpful and so ready to take care of everything that I started to think, hey, maybe I didn't have it all right. And what was so ironic to me was I did have some pro-choice friends that were supportive of my choice to keep the baby. But it was always the pro-choice people who were also mad that I made the decision to keep the baby.
Right.
And so it started to be like, well, I guess then the only real choice was to have an abortion, because that would have been the choice that kept it hidden,
yeah,
that didn't cause the problems, that kept everybody else going without causing this very public scandal. So that was sort of the moment my worldview kind of started to shift a little bit.
Well, let's take a little break there, and we'll pick back up and see the continuing grace coming out of that. But, you know, what an amazing turning point. The phrase that sticks in my head, you know, is this, you know, finding myself, right?
Yeah.
That's another one of these phrases we pick up from the culture, our kids hear, mm-hmm, and it too becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I believe that I have to go and sort of make myself or find myself,
right,
out there. The way we find ourselves, right, is when God happens to us,
right,
you know, when reality breaks through.
Right.
Sometimes that happens through new life, right?
Right.
It's a beautiful story. I want to hear more. So we'll be back here in just a minute. Again, tonight we're speaking with Lauren DeWitt. She's a former Southern Baptist, and her website is thecontemplativehomemaker.com. And we'll hear more of her story here in just a moment. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grody, and tonight we've been speaking with Lauren DeWitt. She's a former Southern Baptist pastor's kid, and her website is thecontemplativehomemaker.com. And boy, great story so far, Lauren. Where we left off, you know, you just had this experience of grace mm-hmm, breaking through in the form of new life, and then the unexpected, it was to you unexpected, but this wonderful homecoming,
yeah,
and welcoming back in your family, your community. Just a powerful story there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What happens next?
Yeah, so I'm starting, you know, I didn't know anybody. My parents had moved back to Baton Rouge while I was in law school, and I'd been born in Baton Rouge, but we left there when I was two. So I moved back there. I'm pregnant. I don't know anybody at all, and I feel like I'm beginning to build my life from scratch. But I had to live a very different life because I knew how to take care of my baby, right? I had to be a responsible adult. And so I start making very different choices about how I'm spending my time. I start going back to church. I'm going every week, if nothing else, so that my daughter can have the moral structure and that she'll have people around her that love her and that sort of thing. And it was around that time, you know, I'm also despairing at this time because I don't think, you know, I'm never going to find a dad for her that's going to take care of both of us. Like, nobody's going to want to be with somebody that's been through what I went through. And when she was 2 months old, God sent my now husband into our lives. And that was the second time. So the first time I really felt God break through was when I found out I was pregnant. The second time was when I met Aaron. And I just knew from the moment we met, I was like, oh my goodness, we're going to get married. And we did. We got married when she was two. And he's been with her, since she was 2 months old. So he's been with us every step of the way. And he was Methodist. And so we got married in the Methodist church. We had Emily Grace baptized Methodist. And we're kind of rocking along. We're making very different choices now. I've got a lot more stability in my life. I'm starting to be happy. But there's still a disconnect in some ways. I'm not going to church every single Sunday. I'm not really praying yet, that sort of thing. I'm doing kind of the one-off Bible study and this sort of thing. And then I meet a girl at my work. And she is, again, I thought all people that took their faith seriously were very prudish and not very fun and not very smart. Well, my friend, she became one of my best friends, smart, beautiful, really funny. And then after we have this friendship that's built on all these secular things, I find out she's Catholic. And it's around this time I'm going to a lot of therapy just from all the PTSD that I put myself through. And my therapist recommended that I start doing some sort of mindfulness meditation techniques. And for whatever reason, something about doing it the way the therapist suggested, I was like, that just feels sort of like Eastern-y to me. I don't know. You know, I'm going to church now. There's got to be a way that I can do this, maybe with just Jesus, this sort of thing. And that's when I remember, wait, Catholics have this thing called a rosary. And I'm like, they stopped doing that in the Middle Ages. But I wonder if Sarah, I wonder if my friend Sarah's ever heard of this thing. So I call her up. We're at work. I'm like, hey, do you know about the rosary? And there's just this silence on the other end. She's like, yeah, I know about the rosary. So I start asking her questions about it. And she starts explaining it to me. And I'm like, wait, that sounds like a really good way to kind of get relief from some of this anxiety. And sounds like sort of what my therapist is telling me to do about just being present and calming my mind, that sort of thing. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'll start looking into that. Well, I was terrified to go into a Catholic bookstore and actually buy a rosary because I thought they would like know that I didn't belong there. Like somehow I would like have like heretic on my head or something. I don't know. So my friend Sarah lent me one of hers and taught me how to pray it. And of course, I just started having questions. It's like, why is this okay? I remember praying the first time before I prayed it. I was like, God, if this offends you, I'm really sorry. I'm trying something here. And lightning did not come strike me down. So that was good. And I'm praying it secretly because I don't want my husband to know at this point because I'm not ready to tell him that I'm trying this weird rosary thing that people stopped doing in the Middle Ages. But then I'm having all these questions. I'm like, why are we praying to Mary? Why is that okay? Where did this Hail Mary prayer come from? What the heck is the assumption of Mary? Like, why do we think that she's coronated? Like, what is all this stuff? And so I start having to research things. And I'm, we have this like inner office chat. And so I'm like messaging my friend all the time. Like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And then so I'm asking her all these questions. And among this time too, I start asking her questions about, I find out Catholics don't allow the use of birth control and things like that. And I'm like, that's insane. That is absolutely the most insane thing I've ever heard of. Like, how can you possibly believe that? And she's like, well, I don't use it. I'm not planning to. And I was like, it blew my mind. I didn't know anybody. She was the first person I had met that was doing something so radically countercultural. I kind of just expected her to be like, oh, that's something the church teaches, but, you know, we don't really do that kind of thing. Now, she was full on, like, if it's what the church teaches, that's what we do. And that was one of the first real crystallizations where I had seen somebody being unrelenting in following what the church said. They weren't going to live two separate lives. They weren't going to do things in one way in Mass on Sunday and then do things that they just thought were the right thing that the church got wrong on their own. And that was huge to me because, again, she was this smart, cool girl. She was fun to be around, but she was so faithful. And I could see through her faithfulness, things hadn't always been easy for her, but it had also worked out somehow. And she'd saved herself a whole lot of the heartache that I had gone through. So I start learning about NFP. I'm married at this point. Natural family planning, yeah. Yes. I start thinking, gosh, I should get off birth control. I should stop doing this. I start learning about theology of the body. It's blowing my mind. All this stuff I'm learning about Mary is totally blowing my mind. And so it comes to this point where I need to start telling people like, hey, I'm looking into this stuff and I think the Catholic Church has something to offer here.
And your husband at this point, was he?
This is when I first brought him in.
Okay. People.
I was like, people, aka my husband and my parents. I want to start going to Mass. I've been praying the rosary, and I want to start taking these classes. My parents were thrilled. Again, we grew up so in such a culturally Catholic area that it wasn't that big a deal to them. They were just happy that I was praying and going to church and taking my faith seriously. My husband, on the other hand, grew up in more of a Bible Belt area of Louisiana, where it's heavily Protestant, and he very much saw it as me changing religions. And especially when we had entered into our marriage with plans about how we were going to plan our family, we were going to use hormonal birth control, we were going to do these kind of things, and then I'm telling him, hey, I don't think we can do that anymore and this kind of stuff. So it caused a real rift. So I went to what I call bootleg RCA, where I met on my lunch breaks with one of the faith directors at one of the parishes in town. And because I didn't want it to be any sort of impingement on my husband's schedule at all, to where he'd have to be watching the kids and that sort of thing. And then it was a little over 5 years ago, yesterday actually was my confirmation anniversary, that I had finished all of the classes on my lunch breaks, and I went to the parish, the priest at the parish that we lived in. I said, please don't make me wait to Easter. I promise. I believe all of this. I need the Eucharist. I need reconciliation. Please don't make me wait. And to his credit, he didn't know me from Adam. but he brought me in on the Feast of the Holy Name of Mary. He confirmed me. I went to the Sacrament of Reconciliation. I'm telling you, I went to therapy for 14 years. I have never experienced healing like I did after that first confession. Guilt, shame, it washed away. I finally was able to feel that personal connection. Receiving Christ in the Eucharist, it doesn't get more personal than that.
Yeah.
And so I was finally experiencing all the things that I had been looking for so long. And my life improved dramatically at this point.
How did you get to that spot? Even before receiving the sacraments, mm-hmm. because then you receive them and you do have this experience. How did you get to the place where you wanted them so much? You know, in terms of the way you saw the world and how you saw your faith.
So I spent about a year asking my friend questions, and she was hooking me up with other priests and other people who teach the faith or know catechism and that sort of thing for questions that she couldn't answer. And she was lending me books, and I was just like voraciously devouring. Watching EWTN like all the time. It was on my radio, learning all of these things. And I think theology of the body particularly had a huge way on my just entire sacramental worldview shift.
Yeah.
Because before, things had been so fragmented for me.
Mm-hmm.
But then realizing, wait, my body was designed in a particular way to work a particular way for the purpose of creating new life. And I think, you know, I had all this trauma from getting pregnant outside of wedlock where it had been seen as just this bad thing. But then it was what brought me to God. And so I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense then that our bodies in some way are reflective of the Creator. And so I think theology of the body, starting to see how He's in every moment, even in the hard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was there with me the whole time in every mistake that I was making, and he never abandoned me. And so just having that worldview shift really helped. And then once I realized, like, sacraments, that makes sense then, right?
Yeah.
It's grace working through material. I have experienced grace working through material things outside of the church mm-hmm. in my life. Makes sense to me that this is how He would work.
That sacramental worldview is such a big deal. Mm-hmm. And it is really interesting that you bring up theology of the body there, because mm-hmm. that's something I've certainly seen. My wife and I experienced that in college campus ministry, that as an opening, as a portal mm-hmm. to the sacramental worldview, theology of the body is unique in the sense of the sacramental worldview, as a Catholic, we recognize that every single thing, everything that mm-hmm. God has created, is to lead us to Him.
Right.
You know, if you scratch the surface a little bit. But in theology of the body, we're faced with something that's so close and personal, mm-hmm. our own bodies, our own sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we catch the vision there, that in this something that's so intimate and precious,
mm-hmm.
this is where God is breaking into our lives and showing us His glory and our vocation, the glory He wants to draw us to, that does really open you up to, you know, is the whole world like this?
Yeah.
And that's the Catholic worldview.
Right. And that's when I felt like I was coming out of the matrix. I was like, everything means something. Yes. Like, none of this is random.
I love that phrase.
you know, and I remember reading Carol Houselander early on there, and she's got this great quote in the Read of God about how, you know, the snow is white because of the virgin's purity and the seed grows because he was incarnate. And like, so it's like, oh my goodness, it's in everything. It's every part of creation. It's every relationship. It's so crystallized in my marriage and in having children. And I could see him working in ways that I just never realized he could work. I'd put him in such a box and said, you're over there and I've got to handle the rest of this on my own. But then to realize like he's calling to me through every single moment, every created thing was huge.
Yeah. And it answers that question you'd had way back in your childhood or one of the connected issues there of, you know, so now I've come to Christ, been baptized, but now what?
Right.
You know, and if there's not the next step, this disconnect grows. But, you know, the sacramental worldview, what it gives you is everything's now an opportunity.
Yes.
I don't walk around, you know, because the faith meets us where we're at. But now everything is this opportunity to grow. My marriage, my family, my children, my work, everything is to be sanctified and turned over and placed under the Christ's lordship.
Right.
Okay, so you become Catholic.
Yes, I became Catholic.
Yeah.
2 or 3 years later, my husband ended up coming into the church.
How'd that happen?
I wish I could take credit for it. I was ready to be St. Monica's like buddy for life and just be praying for like 20 years for his conversion.
Yeah.
He came in one day and said, I met with Father. And I was like, what Father? He's like, you know, Father at church. And I'm going to start RCIA. I almost fell out of my chair. I think he'd gotten to a point where he could see so many changes in me, in the way I was approaching our marriage. Our daughter at this point was maybe 4 or 5. She was starting to ask questions like, well, why does mommy get to take communion at Mass and why can't daddy? And to him, he's like, no, our family needs to be unified and on this. So he went to check it out. He was like, this seems reasonable. So he came into the church in 2020. And then just this past Easter, both my parents actually came into the church as well.
Wow.
So.
And so, again, for them, there was a similar thing in the sense of seeing your life and then being open to studying?
I think so. And, you know, just asking the right questions and then just dealing with their own, you know, everybody's broken. Everybody's got mistakes. And then seeing that, you know, I found this real healing in reconciliation and then realizing they could find that kind of healing too. And goodness, the difference I've seen in them, even in just like the 6 months since they've been receiving the sacraments, like it's incredible how much that grace works. But yeah, again, I can't take credit for any of that. It was nothing I did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's how it works though, right? Mm-hmm. If we just are faithful, then God works through that. I'm sure what they saw in you was by and large, not a refutation of any of their faith,
right?
But a compliment, a fulfillment.
That was what was so great about the way my Southern Baptist upbringing was, isn't it? And I've talked to my dad about this too. I never felt like it was any of the teachings of Catholicism were a rejection. To me, they were always like, oh, that's the very logical next step. That's the fulfillment of where we had been. Oh, I see how we were short on that issue before. And so it was coming home. It really was for both of us and for my mother as well.
That's beautiful. Okay. So talk more about then your family life and your work. We're going to hear now about your website, the Contemplative. Oh, you just took it off the screen here. What's the website
it's
again?
It's thecontemplativehomemaker.com.
Great. Talk about that a little
bit. Yeah. So I was a practicing attorney because I did graduate from law school and I practiced law for about 7 years. We had 3 children at this point. It was just very busy. And so we finally got to a place where I was able to stay home. And I became very passionate in this time period where I didn't want to go back to this fragmenting dualism that I had experienced. So if I was working on, you know, a brief at the law office, I had to figure out a way, like, how can I make this a prayer? How can I ora et labora kind of thing, but never stop it, not be prayer and work, but prayer and work together. Yeah. And so I got really interested in this idea of how we could just pray without ceasing. And so I started doing it some at my work. And then when I was able to stay home, that's when the idea for the Contemplative Homemaker came to me. And I just like, I got to help other people see how everything that we do, something as mundane as doing your laundry, we do it for the glory of God. And He meets us in that moment. And there's grace there.
Yeah. And that's not something extra. I mean, this is what you're now comforting others with the comfort with which you've been comforted. I can't quote that perfectly, but you know, that is not something optional, right?
Right.
Because especially we who are still to be in but not of the world, it's this is the question of our salvation, in the sense of we're called to continue walking, and we've got our life. That's our material.
Right. Right. And so that's the material that the grace needs to flow through. And so once you can start seeing that the liturgy isn't just something you do at Mass, that it really is like that wellspring, I think Benedict calls it, the fount from which all of divine life flows, and it goes out into us, and we're to carry that out into our days. And again, it's not about necessarily picking up the right devotions or doing X, Y, Z, although all those things are good and we need to do those things. But it's about finding ways to, you know, Mother Teresa, you wash the plate because you love the next person who's going to use it. You do the right things. You do the next thing in front of you because that's your duty that God has put in your path, and He's with you in it, in every moment of it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That seems another important piece of that. You know, you talk about liturgical living, mm-hmm. right? Embracing the cyclical nature of life.
Yes,
is important. Talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. So I didn't have any concept of a liturgical calendar growing up. I knew that something like Advent or Lent vaguely existed, mm-hmm. But they did. My life on those days did not look any different from any other day of the week, or from any real secular lifestyle. So to me, when I became Catholic and I learned about the Communion of Saints, first of all, I remember weeping when I learned about the Communion of Saints, and there's people up there that have been praying for me this whole time. And not just up there, but like down here with mm-hmm. me. It was incredible. And I wanted to know everything there was to know about it. And that's when I started learning about liturgical living, which is just this movement to help, particularly within the domestic church, you live the church's calendar more intentionally in your day-to-day life. And so for me, it became a way. You know, I do it for my kids, but I primarily do it because I'm really interested in learning, like, why do we wear purple in this season? Or why are we celebrating, St. Charbel's feast day? Like, who was this guy? Why is he important? And so finding ways to learn about that, and then just seeing how they connect with you in what you're already doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it seems like that the cyclical aspect of it is important because mm-hmm. we don't get it right the first time. Right.
Right.
You know, so we've got this, we get this image of the sacramental universe. Mm-hmm. We recognize we're called to holiness, and it's a process, it's a journey. And so we need the days and the weeks.
Right. It's that constant recapitulation. It's that like living to die mm-hmm. in Christ, right? It's his birth and his resurrection. And we experience that on an hourly basis, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. And so having the liturgical calendar to add that structure, to have liturgy of the hours and things like that, to add that structure and to see like, yeah, the dawn comes every morning the same way Christ comes into the world.
Yeah.
And it sets every night the same way we're all called to die in Him, to rise again the next day. It helps you bring that sacramental worldview more to life. It makes it more concrete, I think.
Right. One of the most basic primordial examples of that is the 6 days of work.
Yeah.
And then the Sabbath.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit, living that as a family.
Yeah. So now we try... it's, again, the Sabbath has become in our day and age such just another work day, another day to get something done. And I realize there's so many things that I'm doing on Sunday afternoon, chores that I'm trying to take care of so I can go do more things during the week. And I was like, that's disorder. That's not right. God rested. I need to rest too. And so on Sundays now, I don't do any laundry. It's like my day off from laundry. We try to waste time together as a family on Sundays and just... because it's not wasting time, right? There is no such thing as wasted time. When you've got a sacramental worldview, it's leisure, it's rest, it's time with each other, it's time to really meditate on what the gospel reading was at Mass. It's time to just enjoy each other in life. That's something you can do really any other day of the week when everything's blowing and going.
Yeah. You brought up that motto, the Benedictine motto, I think, the ora et labora,
yes.
So prayer and work. The Sabbath, right? You talked about we have to grow in praying at all times,
mm-hmm.
and that the goal is eventually that our prayer and our work aren't necessarily a separate thing.
Right.
How does that happen? You know, one of the ways is that when we preserve, and from the beginning we have this commandment to preserve one part of the week, one day, mm-hmm. where even if we think, I could do more good, mm-hmm. I can get more good, I could serve you more, Lord, this day. But he says, no, you're put it aside and practice a different mode of being.
Right.
And that if we practice it there, you know, this being in the presence of God, being in the presence of others, that can begin to spill out.
Right.
Right. And that's the goal.
Right.
Because then the point is that even when we're, writing that brief,
right.
You know, that's too is supposed to be a prayer. But we have to learn how to pray, right?
Exactly.
So we have to have those spaces.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Talk about, because another, you know, in family life, how do we help our kids develop this habit of prayer? How do we invite them into that?
Right. I think it's so important that first you've got to have a strong prayer life on your own, right? They're going to, the kids can sense when you're just putting on or you're doing something just for the kids, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, that's fake. That's what I always hated about that youth group stuff growing up was like, this feels like a very cheap knockoff of something and very geared to elicit a certain response. So I feel like if you're not doing it yourself, it's going to come off very inauthentic with your children, which is why I love liturgical living as much as I do. So you got to work on your own prayer life. Your children need to see you praying. They need to see you say, no, mommy gets up half an hour extra early every day, and I know you're up, and I know you want your breakfast, but you're going to wait because it's mommy's time to pray. Yeah. And they need to see you living the Sabbath as a day of rest and that sort of thing. Another thing that we do, liturgical living has a lot of, if you just go online and Google it, has a lot of practical activities like themed foods. We might have Indian food on Mother Teresa's feast day. So we talk about who she was and that sort of thing. So the kids get to know their faith in sort of a fun and practical way. But one of the biggest gifts, I think, Catholicism does a great job with the Holy Imagination, Lectio Divina. And so helping my children enter into the Bible stories. We'll usually get the daily gospel and I'll say, okay, close your eyes. I want you to imagine like, what are you wearing? What's Jesus wearing? What does his voice sound like when he says this? What's going on? And helping them develop these like really intentional early steps to Lectio Divina so that Jesus is a real person to them. And then we talk about how it's coming into your day. So, okay, so if this is what you think he was telling you this morning, what do you think you could do at school later on? Mm-hmm. Just finding ways to show it's all connected. There is no separate parts.
Right. Yeah, that it's in the imagination has to be formed, just like all aspects of our being have to be formed. And that's why, you know, when we see all of life as an opportunity, these many graces, many opportunities, that they're all opportunities for us to slowly be transformed.
Right.
You know, we're not to be conformed to this age, but transformed by the renewal of our mind. So we need to fill our mind with good things. You know, we bring into our family life all this truth and goodness and beauty. But then we also now have our trajectory, that this is slowly transforming how we think. We want to think and choose and feel like Christ would.
Right.
You know, we want to slowly be transformed into that. What I love about this, right, is I think you've done a great job of giving a bit of the vision. This is part of what we want to present to people, is this vision of the adventure of the domestic church, of family life that most of us are called to. If you would, we have about a couple minutes left, speak to that young woman or man, you know, who's spun off into that secular life.
Yeah.
You know, maybe doesn't think that they'll be welcomed home, you know, because of their mistakes. Speak to them just for a moment, if you would.
I would just say you gotta take the chance. You've got to come back because it's prodigal son, right? Mm-hmm. When the prodigal son in Luke comes back, he comes back not for the purpose of being accepted as the son, but to be just my father's servant. And he's coming back. His father's sitting there waiting for him. He runs out to meet him. He doesn't even let the son get the words out of his mouth before he hugs him and starts dressing him in the clothes of sonship, right? Yep. And you don't have to have it all perfect to come back or to start coming back, because the father, the slightest turn that you make, the slightest openness, the slightest Lord, help me, or just the name of Jesus, that's the opening he needs. He needs the slightest turn, and then he's going to run.
Yeah.
And he's going to come welcome you with open arms.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you so much, Lauren, for your story.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. Again, as Lauren said, if you're someone who, you know, for whatever reason has found themselves separated from Christ, from his church, from your family, this is your sign. Reach out to him today. The Lord loves you. You can't fathom how much he loves you and the grace and the mercy that is outpoured when we just turn and give him an inch. We just give him an open door. And so know that we're praying for you. And that if you need help, you need someone to talk to, if you want companions on your continuing journey, visit chnetwork.org. That's the website of the Coming Home Network International. We're a network of people like Lauren who have come back, who've come home to the Catholic Church. We've found a home in the bosom of Christ and the Catholic Church and His sacraments. And we'd love to assist you and pray with you and pray for you and walk with you on that journey. So check that out at chnetwork.org. Again, this is the Journey Home program. We were speaking tonight with Lauren DeWitt. You'll be able to find her story at chnetwork.org along with so many other powerful stories. So thanks again for joining us. God bless you. We'll talk to you again next week.